Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Billy Burke there, of course, as Glinda from, again, of course, the 1939 classic, The Wizard of Oz. Personally, I like to think I'm a bit of both. And in this bewitching season, we wanted to dive beneath the headlines on what we mean when we say witch. Which brings us to our latest installment of Brilliant Boston, where we learn about some of the most popular classes on the region's campuses. Julie Walsh teaches the well-loved philosophy and witchcraft at Wellesley College and joins us now here in studio too. Julie, welcome.
Thank you so much. Really happy to be here.
So are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Oh, always good all the time. No question. Yeah. Next question.
How long have you been teaching this class, Julie?
So this fall marks the sixth time I've taught it at Wellesley College.
And do students just knock on the door to take this?
I have a significant wait list, yes, yeah, for the class. It's very, very popular. And I think it's one of those classes that has sort of over time built a little bit of a reputation. So its reputation precedes me even on campus, I think.
And so I understand that you do wind up disappointing a few students at the beginning of the course every time, though, because you're not actually teaching. It's not Hogwarts. You're not teaching spells.
Right. Yeah. So the very first time I taught the class, I did get some maybe not negative feedback, but some disappointed feedback that there was no time spent devoted to, you know, cauldrons and mixing and herbal remedies. So I always kind of remind the students that the course code for this class is philosophy, like it or leave it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me about that. Like, how does a layperson get their mind around the fact that there is an intersection between philosophy and witchcraft?
Yeah, so, you know, it's kind of interesting because the way that I've put the course together is my own kind of brand of magic, I would say, in that I love philosophy and I'm a historian of philosophy by training, but that's not really the sexiest subdiscipline of philosophy. And so when I started developing this class, I thought, you know, we have all these really interesting questions about power, about knowledge, about how knowledge and power intersect and mutually reinforce one another. And it can sometimes be challenging to get undergraduate students interested in those questions, thinking about their own power and their own perspectives on knowledge and on the world. And it struck me that the early modern witch hunts, especially teaching at Wellesley College, where we're just a stone's throw from Salem, Massachusetts, would be a great case study through which to explore questions of perspective, power, agency, and sexism.
So we're speaking with Julie Walsh, who's an associate professor of philosophy at Wellesley and teaches a class on philosophy and witchcraft. So now I imagine you use at least one class session, if not more, to do this case study on power and knowledge and Salem.
Mm-hmm.
But let's do the abridged version here. And what are the basics of that case study from the perspective of philosophy and witchcraft?
Yeah. So Salem presents a really interesting and in some ways challenging case study for us, in part because our sort of lay understanding of what happened in Salem is not quite true. So Arthur Miller might have something to do with that with respect to the way that the case study is presented through the Crucible. But, you know, what we know is that 19 people were executed. One further person was killed for refusing to accept responsibility for being a witch. Many, many, many more died in prisons awaiting their day in court. And one of the things that I really want my students to understand from this is to think about the beliefs of the parish minister who was really in charge of a lot of the witch hunts in Salem, but also the beliefs of the townspeople, the neighbors that turned on one another, the neighbors that refused to turn on one another. What was driving their beliefs and how did those beliefs really motivate their actions in these incredibly violent, interactions among community members? So we kind of take a pull back and think about the religious community, the economic community. I always remind my students that in 1692 in New England, especially for people who were coming from England and new to the area, I always say to my students, when you think about Boston in February, what do you think about? And they say, ice, snow, and I say, okay, and in 1692, much, much, much worse. And then, of course, we also have the situation where there were people already living in New England who did not wish to be colonized. So there's sort of an interesting mix of elements that make life in Salem in 1692 incredibly difficult. So we kind of look at it in terms of the pressures on the community members and how that may have created a situation where something had to give. And so scapegoating is another really big theme that we explore in the class.
And of course, for those who don't know the history, just a couple of key points. You know, a prominent family has a daughter who starts to display things that might look like epileptic seizures. Eventually, there's several girls display these. There's an enslaved person from the Caribbean, Tituba, who they say is a witch. Mm-hmm. One of the things in the years that I've read historians on this, I've gone on history tours. One of the things that has stuck with me, Julie, is this idea that at that time, lying was a sin that was damnation.
Right.
And so the idea that girls might accuse someone and be lying from a religious philosophy standpoint was kind of inconceivable.
Yeah. This is one of the things that I think from our contemporary perspective is hard to wrap our minds around, is that the people, I think, making the accusations were not doing it maliciously. They believed it. And I think, you know, one of the concepts actually we talk about in my class is chronological xenophobia, which I love. Mm. So it's this idea that we shouldn't, from our present day perspective, look at the past and think, oh, those people didn't know anything. And if I were there today, I wouldn't have believed any of that
stuff.
Exactly. And so kind of thinking about the way that if you grow up in a community where everybody you trust and love believes in magic and believes that the devil is real and the devil walks among us, it makes sense that you too would believe it. And so thinking about the accusations, you know, if you imagine the way that community members turned on one another, it's horrifying to us. But I think you're exactly right that it is, in a sense, too easy an explanation to think that people were just lying or trying to get each other in trouble because the stakes were so high.
We're speaking with Julie Walsh, the associate professor of philosophy at Wellesley College, who teaches philosophy and witchcraft. We've just been talking about the Salem witch trials as a case study there. And you have said, Julie, that, you know, it's the beliefs and philosophies of participants in witchcraft, witch hunts, witch trials, et cetera, over the centuries is a piece of this. And I'm assuming that also fear of women who buck oppression is a piece of what gets one assigned a witch, but also taking power might make one want to say, yeah, I'm a witch. So talk about that.
Right. So one of the very first readings we do in the class is a kind of historical account of the myth of Adam and Eve and where that brings us today.
So you go all the way back.
We go all the way back, right? Well, actually, unfairly, one of the first questions I ask my students is, where does sexism come from? Like, we have 75 minutes. Let's see if we can figure it out. But one of the ways that we can think about it is the way that the stories that weave through our lives tell us something about people and about ourselves. And the myth of Adam and Eve has this outsized role in the way that women are portrayed. So one of the readings we do in our class near the end of the term is about Marvel and the way that Marvel portrays women, especially women with power. And you see this sort of dichotomy between the sort of weak, meek woman who's nothing to be feared and maybe somebody to be cared for. And then you have this woman who is an incredibly powerful and scary and vengeful being. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of daylight in between.
Yeah, I guess I never thought of that. But, you know, in the Avengers series, the most, arguably one of the most powerful is the Scarlet Witch. I mean, they actually call her a witch.
Yeah. Well, and for anybody who's watched WandaVision, we know that the exploration of that character with respect to her power and her maternity. So motherhood becomes a really big issue there. And motherhood and fertility plays another incredibly prominent role in the history of the witch hunts through time.
So say some more about that.
Yeah. Well, so over time, we see the many women who are sort of under the you know, scrutiny of their communities are women who have miscarriages, who have infants who die in infancy or who die in labor and delivery. There's a lot of debate actually in the scholarship about how suspicious midwives were in the era. So midwives, of course, played an incredibly important role in the early modern world, well, and still today. How much they were accused in virtue of that role is still sort of unclear. But any interference with fertility was looked at with great suspicion. So even some medieval church fathers like St. Thomas Aquinas talks about witchcraft, and his focus is on the way that witches may impede fertility and procreation. So there's an interesting connection here, I think, between perceptions of magic, power for women, and that women will use that power to prevent pregnancy or terminate pregnancy. So of course, we see really interesting connections still today with conversations around fertility and the way that people who can become pregnant can control their own fertility and make those decisions for themselves. So in the early modern world, any suspicion that somebody has tampered with procreation was looked at as potentially something to do with witchcraft, because only the devil would want to stop more Christian babies from being born.
Interesting. All right. We're speaking with Julie Walsh, who's Associate Professor of Philosophy at Wellesley College, about her brilliant Boston course, Philosophy and Witchcraft. So in 2021, here on Radio Boston, we talked to photographer Frances Denny, who produced a collection of images of people who identify as witches today. And I want to come to the now.
Great. Right?
It was displayed at Peabody Essex Museum, and here's how she talked about her subjects.
You have people who would consider themselves pagan, many who don't consider themselves pagan. There are people who practice mysticism or engage with the occult. There are politically oriented activist witches, polytheists also, who work within a pantheon of goddesses. There are tarot readers, astrologers, people who practiced spellcraft.
So that's today, and I do think part, you mentioned this earlier, I think, what did you call it, chronological xenophobia?
Yeah.
I just love that.
That's great.
So, you know, this idea that we would look in the past and say, well, they just didn't know any better, right? But we have mostly embraced science today, and the idea that there would be witchcraft is a challenging thought, but this is identity witches.
Right.
So how do you talk about that in your class?
Yeah, actually, so last fall, my students and I went to the Peabody Essex, so we saw that exhibit and loved it.
Your class went?
Yeah, one of the highlights of our course is every November we go to Salem. So I used to go in October and then realized, no,
that's crazy.
That's not, the drive alone is not really worth it. But we go in November now, and we saw it last year, and we talked about that. And I think one of the things that becomes really interesting when you learn about the history of the witch hunts is that the people who were accused and executed for witchcraft in the early modern world themselves hated witches. Everybody hated witches and thought they should die. And so there's something very interesting about thinking about present day people who identify as witches and what connection, if any, they have to this historical group of people who were persecuted. And I think that's a really tough question to answer, because the people who were persecuted themselves did not think of themselves as witches. And we have no evidence that they practice anything like what, you know, contemporary witches practice. So there's an interesting question here about, my students often say, are present day witches appropriating something they are not entitled to? And it makes me think of one of the readings we do in the class says that witchcraft is a crime with a hole at the center because there were no witches. Mm. So it's an interesting question whether you can appropriate a culture that didn't exist.
And has our history of the way we've thought about witches and witchcraft varied based on white European traditions versus,
right,
let's say, Black and Brown Caribbean or,
exactly,
African traditions?
Right. So when we talk about the witch hunts of Salem and you know, Western Europe in the early modern world, it's very much a kind of Christian-centric, white-centric view of witchcraft. I think the case of Tituba, who you mentioned a few moments ago, is really interesting. And just for context, Tituba, when she was the first person accused, she admitted everything, went to jail, and she was one of the few people who was released from jail and survived the ordeal. And there's no trace of her after that, to which I say, good. Mm-hmm. Get out of here, Tituba. You know, whatever happened to her next, I hope
Run
she lived
for
a great
your life.
Yes.
Yeah.
So So we do, at the end of our course, talk about brujeria. We talk about the way that witch hunts in certain parts of the world, especially in certain countries in Africa, are still ongoing. And we also talk about the way that the word witch hunt in the U.S. has been employed time and time again.
Politically.
And thinking about whether anyone today, especially a politician, is entitled to use the term witch hunt for their own situation, or whether that's a bridge too far given its history.
So one last question for you, Julie. At the end of the class, what is it that you want your students to understand that they didn't at the beginning?
Oh, that's such a great question. I think what I want them to understand is that if there is something we believe and we are certain about it, we have to be able to say why. And lots of the things that we believe and that we hold dear are things that we haven't questioned yet. And I think questioning doesn't mean we have to give it up, but I think it does mean that we have to have a set of really good reasons to offer to the world for why we believe them. And if my students come away from my classes with that piece of knowledge and that kind of power, I'd be really, really happy.
All right. Julie Walsh is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Wellesley, Professor of the popular course Philosophy and Witchcraft. Julie, thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.